Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the last panel of the conference, and I would like to begin by saying what an honor it has been to serve on the organizing committee of this conference. And for the speakers, I want to emphasize that certainly my work on this conference is not done, as I'm hoping to assemble all of your papers to publish them in a separate volume. On the margins of some of the presentations this morning, Monsieur Meran and I had an opportunity to exchange a few words, and we thought that the commentary was at a very high level. So in contrast to that, I want to say that in the same way as an army runs on its stomach, a democracy runs on its elections. Et nous sommes ici pour faire la cuisine. I'm only the chair of this panel, and I intend to be very severe with all of the other members of the panel in terms of timing. But if you'll allow me just a few comments by way of characterization of the subject matter, what's important in terms of the contribution of the electoral sector to the development of Canada over the last 150 years is the direction of the evolution that has taken place. We have a system that is, to borrow an expression, free and fair, but more than that, free, fair, transparent, and honest. And the consequence of that evolution is the primary characteristic that is necessary for electoral systems to be well regarded. And that is the question of legitimacy. For the most part, candidates and political parties in this country live within the ambit of their rights. They respect this concept of legitimacy. And indeed, that is true in relation to the vast number of democracies around the world today. And in a sense, the best methodology to adopt in terms of assessing the concept of elections and the carrying out of elections is by way of interjurisdictional and, in particular, international comparison. If you take a look at what has happened only in the last 12 months or so, you will find that a presidential election in the otherwise well-regarded Republic of Austria has been declared null and void by the constitutional courts in that country because of irregularities. If you look more recently, the same scenario has taken place in the Republic of Kenya. I don't need to say anything about what happened in the fall of 2016 in the United States in terms of legitimacy and in terms of accusations about people who voted illegally and the apparently millions of individuals whose votes ought not to have been counted. These are instances where the legitimacy of elections was called into election. For the most part, perhaps it is even possible to say for all of Canada's history in the last 150 years, that kind of scenario has not taken place. What we have in this country is a number of fundamental principles. The right to vote that is attached to citizenship and to age. The concept of one person, one vote that is applicable in all of our jurisdictions. the secrecy of the vote, the neutrality of polling places, peace and order at elections, the professionalism of the vote count, and perhaps underlying all of this is the autonomy of the electoral administration. Lest the chair take up too much time and take time away from all the members of the panel, I would like to invite the gentleman who until recently was the Chief Electoral Officer of Canada, Monsieur Marc Meron, to now continue the discussion.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. Thank you to the organizers for setting up this conference and inviting me to participate and contribute meaningfully, I hope. C'était l'occasion pour moi d'apprendre que le collège était un collège, une institution bilingue qui offrait tous ses programmes dans les deux langues officielles. Bravo. Excusez mon ignorance. Elle est maintenant chose du passé. Et je me ferai un apôtre de partager ses connaissances. Canada's electoral democracy at 150. We could have a two-day seminar on that topic. But I'll keep it short and focus on some key areas that in my mind need improvement. But first, let's ask ourselves, how are we doing? If you look, Mr. Tardy pointed out to events happening in other jurisdictions around the world. If you look at various indexes that are published regularly, trying to assess the effectiveness of electoral regime around the world, Canada generally ranks among the top 10 out of 180 countries or so who have experience with democracy. The top five are generally the Nordic country, European Nordic country, and some of the continental Europe. Canada ranks ahead of UK, France, Australia, and more ahead of the US in these days and times. In fact, the US has been losing ground over the last several years. It did not start with the 2016 election for sure. They have lose ground because of the tactics over there, some of them pretty open, tactics of suppressing votes. The gerrymandering that takes place about redistricting of seats, barriers that are set up to prevent people from voting, uneven allocation of budgets so that in poorer neighborhood you have longer wait lines than in other jurisdictions who have more money. Nothing of this you would see in Canada. So again, we are doing fairly well. Especially in the context of our history, of our diversity, which is the seven components of our civic culture that we're starting to embrace, as well as our geography. Yet there are a few areas that need improvement in my mind. The first one, I would say participation in election is an issue. It drags down Canada when you compare it to other countries around the world. Turnout in elections at all levels, whether it's municipal or provincial or federal, have been declining for the last 40 years. It's been driven mostly by weak youth participation. And here when we talk about youth, we talk about those who are 18, 25, so those who are first time or second time voters, possibly. Their participation rate in the last five elections, except for one, I'll get back to that in a moment, was less than 40%. So first-time voters go to the polls only at the rate of one in three or so, a little bit more than that, not much. That's a particular concern because what we've started to see over that period of time is what we call generational transfer, meaning that if you don't start to vote early on, you're not likely to ever start to vote. In fact, there's many studies that point out that if you haven't voted in your first two elections, you're likely not to, to vote at any time. So we've seen now the decline, which was mostly related to youth, now to get over older generation. And from election to election, we lose roughly 10% of participation by generation. There was the 2015 election, which was a bit of an exception. 8% increase in total participation. That's the highest increase over a single election in our history. Youth participation increased by 18%, still well below the average of other groups, but still much better. Aboriginal participation also increased by 20% in the last election. So there are interesting phenomena there that happened in 2015. The matter is, the issue is whether it's going, it was an outlier or will carry on in future elections. The second area of improvement in my mind is representation, particularly with regard to women in electoral processes. Women have barely hit 25% of representation in the House of Commons. It's been at that level for a while now, varying between 20-25%, never going higher than 25%. Canada ranks poorly around the world in those regards. So I believe some initiatives will be required to address this gap of representation. Some argue that these measures would need to be legislated. Many countries have adopted quotas. Emerging democracy basically all have quotas in terms of representation, gender representation. There may be other measures which are financial or other measures relative to political parties also that can be think of to induce better representation for women in our elected bodies. Aboriginal representation, there's been a lot of discussion about our relationship with Aboriginal communities. The Aboriginal representation, that's interesting because it's at par with the proportion of population in the country. Currently, I believe we have 10 or 11 Aboriginal MPs in the House of Commons, which roughly represents 3%, which is roughly the percentage of the population. Obviously, that's not a proper way to address the relationship we have with the First Nations communities, and we'll have to, again, think outside the box to address that issue. Positively, there were a few districts in Canada where all candidates were Aboriginal. That was the first also in the last election, mostly in the West, Saskatchewan, Manitoba. But I thought that that was interesting. The other area of representation where we are falling behind given the change of our demographic is visible minorities in the House of Commons. Very few studies being looking at that phenomena. It is growing, but it's still far below the representation in the population. So that's the second area, representation, participation, was the first one. The third one is what I would call the level playing field or fairness in our elections. The level playing field concept was endorsed by the Supreme Court of Canada, and it basically deals with political financing. Again, I was mentioning to Mr. Tardy earlier that money is like, it's a little bit like water. It finds its way, whatever stuff you try to put at it, it will find its way through. So it requires constant vigilance as to how we regulate the influence of money in our system. The other thing about the level playing field, which also relates a bit to political financing, is the barriers that are set up that are increasingly difficult to overcome for independent candidates and new parties. It is such today that the financial regime itself is becoming a significant impediment for new parties to emerge credibly and offer alternatives to Canadians. The other aspect of fairness in our electoral process, and this one it's interesting because in some regard it's enshrined in the Constitution, it's the unequal value of votes across the country. The weight of a vote in Toronto is 4 times less vote than PEI, for example, Prince Edward Island. Some of it in PEI is guaranteed by the Constitution, but generally, I think it's fair to say, it's correct to say that a vote in an urban center is half the value of a vote in a rural riding in this country. And that, again, when you look at it from an international perspective, this is a drag on the performance of our electoral system. Now, there's been current effort at improvement. I'll be very short on this, given our time. A lot of activities taking place at the federal, provincial level, looking at two aspects, generally. When looking at their electoral democracy, government has tended to look at two-pronged approach. First of all, looking at the alternative voting system to help address the representation issues. We've had the discussion at the federal level last year, which ended up with a clear stop for the time being, so we will remain with the first-past-the-post system. The provinces are looking, still looking at the alternative system. PEI had a referendum last year asking its citizens to choose between four systems. A proportional system came out on top. It's interesting, the referendum was a preferred ballot system used. it led to a preference for a proportional system. The government indicated that they will have a second referendum to validate that choice, and should be coming, I believe, in the next year. We know that New Brunswick also promised that the government promised if it was to be reelected, it would hold a referendum on an alternative system, did not discuss which one it would be. And of course, we have British Columbia now that is probably the most promising area for this kind of experimentation. Where the government, which is a minority government, has promised a referendum within a year on an alternative system. There are some lessons learned from the efforts of the past. First of all, government and institution have tended to underestimate the investment that needs to be made in education, civic education, so that informed citizens can make a proper choice between various systems. And I would be very concerned to for anyone seeking to change fundamentally our system within a year. Doesn't seem to be realistic at all. The best example we have around the world is New Zealand, which managed to change its voting system, but it took 2 terms. Government, so two governments before changes were put in place. And of course, a successful referendum. Alternatively, to looking at how to change the system, pretty much all governments across the country are looking at how we modernize our voting process, how we modernize our electoral framework. At the federal level, there's already 2 pieces of legislation that are before the House of Commons. One is Bill C-33 that deals with the famous, quote, cash for access, quote, practices that exist still. There's also a bill that tries to address some of the concerns that were raised under legislation introduced under the previous government. That legislation will also deal with voting by Canadians abroad, which is the object, the subject of a dispute that's now being awaiting a hearing in the Supreme Court of Canada. And it will also deal with identification rule at the poll. But that's just the start, and I don't know how the current government will be able to succeed on what is on its agenda. If you look at the Liberal Party platform, if you look at the speech from the throne, if you look at the minister mandate letter, there's a vast, very substantive agenda in terms of electoral reform for the federal level. They want to look at pre-writ spending. Most jurisdictions in Canada have now adopted fixed date election. Well, that's moved the spending from between during the writ to prior to the writ. So vast sum of money are spent in the months preceding the election, which again raise issue about the fair level playing field. The cash for access we mentioned. Another issue that was much discussed at the during the last elections, leaders debate. Should they be governed at all, or how should they be governed? That was a major issue last time around. There were no national broadcasting of the debates. They were available on the internet or on specialized channels here and there. And Minister Gould, in her mandate letter, is tasked to address the issue of leaders' debate. Cybersecurity is also becoming a significant issue. It's interesting because when you look at what's been happening in the US, it was basic stuff that were breached. Email system basically was the first evidence of security breach, and it was geared at a particular political parties. But these are issues that need to be tracked, and we need to see how to address them or prevent them in Canada. I would say that in addition to those briefly mentioned items, I would say that managing information in the era of internet and social media is becoming very much an electoral issue. We've seen what's happening in the US, and I think we will need a serious debate as to whether it's proper to try to regulate the internet, what's the best way to do so if we choose to do so, and who should be responsible to do it. We cannot stay just put and wait for things to happen. I'm very worried now with one of the things that technology has done for election is that it has basically eliminated barriers to participation, when you think of it. Information feels freely, unfiltered, and you never know exactly what you're reading is true or not, except if you go on very reliable sources. But if you rely on Twitter, for example, or other social media, not naming all of them, it's difficult at times to figure out what's credible, what's not there. And what we're finding with the experience in the US, and we saw that a bit of that in Canada, not to the scale, is that there are entities, organizations, individuals that are very sophisticated at masking the source. And to track and validate whether the information they provide is credible or should be credible. That is an emerging issue. I think it's becoming a pressing issue because the quality of democracy depends on how well informed citizens are. And if the well of information is poisoned, it doesn't bode well for the choices that electors will make. So I don't have an easy fix for that, but it is something that I hope parliamentarians and civil society will start to look at much more closely and start to devise ways of containing negative impact of this misinformation on our democracy. In conclusion, I would say that Canadians have every reason to be proud of their democracy. No, when we look at ourselves in the mirror, like, comment on dit ça en français? Quand on se regarde dans le miroir, on se désole, mais quand on se compare aux autres, on se console. Je pense qu'il y a, il y a beaucoup de matière à afficher notre fierté vis-à-vis de nos institutions démocratiques, mais sans devenir complaisant. Il y a toujours des améliorations nécessaires qu'il faut faire dans un délai raisonnable. Et je pense que le pire ennemi serait la complaisance. Parce qu'une chose qu'on observe en démocratie, on le voit dans les pays un peu partout dans le monde, c'est que lorsque la confiance des citoyens est brisée, c'est très difficile de la remettre en place. C'est pas impossible, mais c'est long, c'est lent et c'est ardu. Donc, il n'y a pas de place à la complaisance. D'un autre côté, je pense pas, une opinion personnelle, je suis un peu en accord avec ce que M. le juge Lebel nous disait plus tôt, je favorise plutôt de l'approche d'une amélioration continue, l'approche un peu des petits pas, qu'une approche révolutionnaire, transformative, dont on ignore suffisamment les conséquences. Canada's electoral democracy definitely needs to keep up with the time if it wants to remain relevant. And again, you can make a difference, you can have an influence on how that electoral democracy evolves. I'll stop up there because I'm sure you're out of time, Mr. Chair. Thank you for allowing me to go on. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the panel for this eminent presentation. As chair, I think there are two things that I need to do vis-a-vis the members of the audience. The first is to ask you to bear in mind the wisdom that is transmitted, and certainly that is the case with today's presentation. The second is particular to this presentation, and that is to take away the lessons learned and the moral of the story, if you will. And I will end the panel and the presentation in the same fashion as I end this particular class in my program at McGill, which is to say that I will presume that all of you are Canadian citizens over the age of 18, and therefore I will ask on behalf of Monsieur Meron, the panelist, and myself, next time around, please vote.
Thank you very much, Greg and Mark. Any quick question? All right, do you have
Sorry, I got here. Well, you come, do you want to join me up here? Okay, this will not take long. Following on Monsieur le juge Lebel, qui parlait du fait qu'il fallait équilibrer non seulement notre charte des droits, mais aussi notre sens de responsabilité civique, nous devons au Canada, sauf certaines exceptions, payer des taxes, nos impôts. Nous devons répondre aux questions de recensement. Why in Canada is it anathema to say we not only have a right to vote, but we're required to vote, as is required in some other democracies? What in principle, never mind the practical issues challenging it, and the fact that we could spoil our ballots if it's a political act not to vote, you could still get up and spoil the ballot. What is your impression in principle about the relationship between the right to vote and the civic responsibility to participate, as Mr. Tardy just suggested, in the voting process? Is it just hortatory that we should do this, or should it be required?
Should it be required? That's a very good question. That was part of my notes, I must say. Some of the things that have been...
Mark, let me just interject. What we could probably do, in the interest of time, is get all of you to ask your questions, and Greg and Mark may give some responses.
Good idea.
So go ahead.
Okay, I have three quick points. I hope I have time. First of all, I'm a bit bothered when I see people saying there should be more women in Parliament. There should be more Native. There's enough Native people. I think the number of demographic categories is infinite, and therefore the best thing is to have people educated. Have them vote, have them stand, make it financially or practically possible for them to stand for office. But I don't like people being divided. We're all Canadians, a Canadian, like just to the Canadians, a Canadian, a Canadian. Okay, that was my first point. My second point is about Canadians abroad voting. I think that should be approached very carefully. If you look at the example of Hungary, that can be used for political purposes. And also, if people have been away more than 3-4 years, and far away, it's difficult to keep up. I know there's the internet and all that, but I think people abroad should, Canadians abroad should be able to vote if they have a connection with Canada, if they stay here, you know, if they're affected by the taxes and everything else that happens if you're here. My third point, I think, is my most important, and I think that is that we should, electoral systems, a form of electoral system should be approached very, very carefully. Just like generals normally prepare to fight the last war, electoral systems are put in place to achieve past, to correct past problems. And sometimes, like in France in 1958, when de Gaulle changed the system, it works very well. Other times, like in Italy, it becomes a disaster. And we need to be really careful, especially in Canada. We have geographic issues, we have diversity issues, and furthermore, I was very involved in the failed attempt by the Trudeau government to change the electoral system. I was very happy with the outcome, but I noted there are interest groups, pressure groups, well organized to favor particular outcomes, which most people don't understand. So it has to be approached very, very carefully. Thank you for giving me the time.
Okay, so I have two questions. One article came out this morning from the Toronto Star that says, why Canada's political pipeline leaves little room for anyone but white men. And it pointed out something that you said regarding representation. So my thing, what is the onus, where do we put the onus? Do we put it on political parties, given their framework in actually getting individuals who represent, obviously, the demographics in the various areas across Canada? Or is that to be legislated? Should we be changing the default? And maybe getting rid of ideas of quota systems, because it seems like they're not effective to some degree. And part two to that is the educational system. The nature of civics education, and I've gone through the Ontario education system, is horrific. It does not teach students anything, and it should be, as far as I'm concerned, since grade one, right? In the most basic of ways. So how do you address that with the nature, given the fact that one, education is the jurisdiction of the provinces, and how are you dealing with that? I've been to like council meetings with student council and things like that, and I there are different school boards, and even the nature of the school boards and how they frame this information is very lacking. So how do we address that, and how do we address that systemically?
I'm actually an undergraduate student from the Keele campus, and I think somebody's already asked a question similar to the lines, but my question is on the constitutionality of mandatory voting, as in some countries. Something I'd like to hear your opinion on.
Yeah, thank you. That was very interesting. Touching on the white men pipeline, if anybody is a mathematician, I'd like to know the odds of having two Bushes and two Trudeaus if it's totally random chance in the pool of 350 million people. I think that would be really interesting. And speaking as somebody under 25 demographic, I can say that, yeah, in the second election, didn't have cable, so Facebook and actually YouTube ads were the most readily available source of when the voting dates even were. So on the notion, first building kind of on the education, also touching on that education of what voting is, probably more people know Pythagoras' theorem than what first past the post. They just gloss over when you say that. But also in what you said, like addressing information, and so kind of a step under obligatory voting, Is there an obligation of the state to provide a certain level of education in the sense? Okay.
My question is, what, in your opinion or your organization's opinion, is the main reason for voters' lack of interest? And what is the resolution to that?
Okay, Mark.
Okay, maybe. Sure.
How long do we have?
You now have another 3 hours.
Maybe to respond or comment on the last question, the main reason for the low participation rate. It's been examined extensively. Initially, you think, well, it may be disappointment or disengagement or distrust about the institution. But when you start to probe a bit, you find very, very quickly that we always come back to the same point. It's lack of information. It's lack of education. Education breeds knowledge, which breeds interest, which breeds engagement. And studies that have been made show that young people who have been exposed to good civic education are 20% more likely to vote when they have a chance. So civic education works. It takes time, and it takes resources. The lack of interest, in my view, is that generally, it's because people are not informed or poorly informed about the topics. And if you look at the Dominion Historica, the former Dominion Institute, they do surveys year after year after year, and that shows how young people, but Canadians generally, how poor knowledge they have of their institution and the functioning of their governments. How they don't understand the distribution of powers between federal and provincial entities and are confused about even municipal authority. So lack of education, lack of information, I would say is the main. Mandatory voting, that's an interesting one. My easy answer is that it's just been examined by the ARRI committee at the federal level that looked at, among other things, online voting, reducing the age of voting, mandatory voting, and voting systems. These are. With regard to mandatory voting, they turned it down. And I think it was unanimous among the members on that committee. Mandatory voting exists. But again, any electoral system is a reflection of the culture of a particular society. I have a hard time personally seeing how Canadians would accept to be forced to attend a polling station. Of course, there's plenty of examples, but I don't know if Canadians would take it well. One of the problems in our system is that absent of a major crisis, it's very difficult to bring forward radical changes. And right now, it's hard to, on the occasion of the 150th anniversary, except maybe for Aboriginals and what's happening there, it's hard to argue that there is a major country that crisis that the country is facing. That's a personal view. Incentive for improving representation. I have a hard time seeing the federal parliament or even provincial legislation adopting quota legislation, but I think they could, the legislators could create incentives for parties to accelerate the representation of their candidates. Could be financial, they could be positive inducement or negative one also. Maybe if you don't have the proper number of candidates, your reimbursement gets less. Or if you have women candidates could claim higher reimbursement possibly. So there are sorts of incentives that are soft and that we would need to see how well they work over time, which fall short of establishing a formal quota. Canadians abroad, well, it's a matter before the Supreme Court right now. I would just point out that our cherished constitution that we discussed for over the last day and a half guarantees the right to vote to every Canadian citizen. You don't have to be in this country. Well, if you read the text, that's basically as broad as those who drafted that charter drafted it. And I know that the argument about the connection with the country has been made again and again, but those who want to remain connected can easily do it nowadays. And those who don't remain connected are not likely to vote. Be surprised that suddenly they're disconnected and suddenly during an election they would start reconnecting just for the purpose of an election. Again, we'll... by the way, I should mention that Bill C-33 is trying to address the issue before the Supreme Court. C-33 would provide that all Canadian citizens, no matter where they are, would be allowed to vote in federal elections. That's the provision of the bill as it stands now. And it's still at second reading before the House of Commons. Civic education, how do we deal with that in such a vast, diverse country? And in a federal regime where there's all sorts of distribution of power. I can only speak for what we've done when I was at Elections Canada. We tried to work with civil society groups, various groups that are nonpartisan, that have a keen interest in civic education. That was one prong to our approach. The other one, because of the nightmare of dealing with all school boards across the country, provincial departments and colleagues at the federal level and all that. What our approach, and again, it's not 100%, was to reach out to teachers directly. So we had forums every year with teachers who teach civic education across the country. We work with them to develop tools for teaching. Is that the better approach? No, I think we need a serious commitment of, again, governments, of course, but also I think parents of advocating their role in terms of civic education for all sorts of reasons. And I think the media can play a role there. So we need a convergence of efforts from all these to try to make a difference, and we need to be patient. It will take time, several years.
Greg, you have a quick comment?
One collective comment on several of the issues that were raised. I agree with you that lack of civic education is one of the restraining factors in voter participation and in citizen engagement. The flip side of that, if you will, is perhaps a personal opinion, but still, if I may, I'd like to express it just very quickly. And that is, a great deal of the fault in this situation should be at the feet of the political parties and the candidates in how they frame the idea of democracy. Democracy is not merely who gives you the greatest tax break and who tries to ensure for you the highest level of annual income. It is a conception of society. Comment est-ce que je vois la société, le pays? If that were the criteria for electability, there would be, I think, a far greater level of interest.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Mark. Thank you very much. I want to end by saying, in my view, and I hope you agree, that this has been a valuable conference, significant for Canada going forward. We at Glendon are very proud to have organized and hosted this conference, but most of all, we are truly grateful to the people who made it possible. The principal and vice principal, I see the vice principal on our left there, Ian Roberge, the organizing committee, Annie on my left, who has worked tirelessly, and Marion Frankian in charge of the principal's administration, Tishini there, Greg on the committee, and the other members of the committee, and I should say also the external advisor to the committee, my former professor, now colleague and dear friend, John White. The sponsors, beginning with Osgoode Hall, the Center for Public Policy and Law, some of the external sponsors and donors, Kyle Moore, Condor, Minto, Fengate, TAC, and Cesario. These are all developers. And, of course, Dr. Lorna Marsden, who's also a contributor. Also, the speakers who delivered very fine papers, the interpreters behind the scene, you, the audience, who attended and participated, and of course, all of the volunteers, all of our volunteers. So my final words are ones of gratitude to those who contributed to what I think we could all agree was a valuable event. We at Glendon say to you, merci beaucoup.
De ma part, j'aimerais bien remercier professeur Presso parce que vraiment, il était l'individu le plus clé pour cette conférence. Un très grand merci. Thank you. Thank you. Parce que vous avez tellement apprécié cette conférence, alors je vous annonce la prochaine conférence. Pour ceux qui sont ici à Toronto le 19 octobre de 7h à 9h le soir, on a une conférence sur l'ALENA. We have a conference on NAFTA and the political implications of NAFTA negotiations. So please do join us on October 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. Indeed, on aimerait vraiment remercier tout le monde, l'audience, les conférenciers. De ma part, je vous souhaite un bon voyage, bon retour à la maison, et puis on va dire à la prochaine conférence. Et s'il vous plaît, retournez les écouteurs aux experts là-bas. Merci infiniment et bon week-end.
Professor Tardy, thank you. I was...